Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 218 featuring Eric Miller of the Noman School. He's actually the CTO of Noman. David
yes.
is joining me today.
Hello.
David, what do you know about the Noman School?
It is a school.
Yes, it is.
It is an amazing school.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Hollywood.
Yep.
They teach everything. Mm-hmm. And I love that they have, not only do they teach CG, but they have like physical modeling classes, and you see these amazing sculptures and
yeah, and hand drawing as well. So it's an art school in a lot of ways.
Yeah, when we did the 100th episode,
mm-hmm.
A student had this amazing statue that she had sculpted
right.
of Deadpool.
Yeah,
remember?
Yeah,
and
she brought it to show it to Tim Miller.
Yeah, and yeah. Tim Miller signed it.
Yeah,
and her head almost, I think it almost exploded. Like it was
pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a really amazing event to go there. But they're really great. They do a lot of stuff for the community and really sort of bring a lot of attention to community. Eric is the other thing that I think is very interesting is that they have a very small student acceptance, right? So there's only about 250 students there total. And they do that because they want to make sure that all of their students have an opportunity to enter the job market. So they have over 90% placement in there, which is really cool.
That is pretty amazing.
That's very high, especially in visual effects, because there's some schools out there that are just churning out students and not everyone's going to get a job, right? So they do that by making sure that they have high caliber students, et cetera. But what's also interesting is, as you know, the visual effects world and the game world, which they teach degrees in both of those things, require a whole lot of technology.
Yes.
A whole lot.
Right, yeah.
And a lot of, and not every studio does the same thing, right? So what Eric Miller does as the CTO is he has to figure out what kind of hardware they need to do and what kind of software they need to do to give everyone the opportunity to learn everything. I think he said it's like 150 or something like that, the number of software packages that he has on every computer.
That's amazing.
Right?
Because he has to stay on top of it
yep.
nonstop.
Yeah. And so he's, different versions of Maya, different versions of V-Ray or Photoshop or Houdini or whatever it is. So lots of great stuff. Really interesting. And they've been around for, they're coming up on their 21st year. So it's been around for a while. So really cool to have Eric Miller on. I've had Alex Alvarez on previously, mm-hmm. who's one of the founders of Noman, and he's really fascinating. So you guys can go back to listen to that one. I did that one several years ago.
And they have a lot of free events that people can attend
mm-hmm.
Almost every week, I believe.
Yep.
And then in ye olden days, they sold, right, like DVDs
yes.
of like training and all. Did you do a DVD?
I did.
was it on podcasting?
No, it was not on podcasting, although I could probably do one at this point on that. It was about V-Ray. It was the first sort of training material that you could get on V-Ray. And it was a long time ago. It's 13 plus years ago that I came up with those DVDs.
Wow.
And they were the only piece of material they had. So Eric Miller, that's when I first started to know him, is because he was helping me with, some of the stuff going on there. It was him and Eric Hansen and Alex Alvarez sort of pitching me the idea of making these training DVDs. And those were a long time ago. So
and they were not cheap at the time.
No,
if I recall.
I don't think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was interesting. It was my first foray into sort of doing content for people. Like, it's the first time I've ever done anything like that. So, and here I am podcasting every week.
I know. Well, like pre-internet, you bought VHS tapes.
Yes.
And you bought DVDs. I mean, I remember buying very yeah. expensive lightwave VHS tapes.
Yeah. And Eric talks about that. I mean, they did, back in those days, they had like DVDs or VHS tapes of Sid Mead drawing, for like 6 hours.
Which is pretty amazing content.
Yes. Pretty good content. Really great content.
Yeah.
All right. We got a couple of announcements, David. We should talk about Total Chaos.
Yeah.
The first thing I want to mention is that it is going to be May 16th, 17th, and 18th. And the 16th is going to be masterclasses, but the talks are going to be on the 17th and 18th. We have some really good speakers lined up. Tell me some names of speakers that we may have had.
It is a laundry list of, it's the who's who of who you should see.
Yeah.
I know Ian Spriggs is going to be there.
Yeah. He's great. He was there last year, but he's got some new stuff to talk about, which is exciting.
I love his approach to how he creates a work too.
Yeah.
His talk last year was amazing.
Yes. And you might have seen, actually, I was speaking of that, I just want to, you may have seen one of his latest portraits, which is of Scott Eaton, who is someone that he met at THU. Well, Scott Eaton himself will be at Total Chaos as well.
Wow, not just his digital and Spriggs double.
Yeah, so he will be there too. So, and he's going to be talking about some really cool stuff he's doing using machine learning and anatomy in CG. So it's really fascinating. Cool. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. And I know Grant Miller is going to be there.
Yes.
Get out.
Grant Miller, get out. What? Well, yes. Well, he did work on Get Out. But Grant is a fantastic person, right? He's like one of our pioneer V-Ray for Houdini guys. Like he's done some amazing stuff there. Yeah. I'm excited about Grant. He's a really good speaker too.
Oh, I've never seen him speak.
Yeah. Well, I know he was really good on the podcast. So. I'm sure he'll be great. Who else is going to be there?
Lots of people.
There's some people from Zaha Hadid Architecture that are going to be there. That's going to be exciting.
Yeah. Oh, Andrew Maximov.
Andrew Maximov, yes. His Promethean AI, I think, is the name of the program he's doing, which is amazing.
So cool.
Yeah. Basically, he's created a 3D, a way to create 3D where everything is reduced to a single button and you just say what you want and it makes it. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I mean that literally, it's magic. And you guys will be able to see that at Total Chaos. So really cool stuff.
He'll make your brain explode, much in the same way that Tim Miller made the woman's brain explode with signing the Deadpool statue.
Yes, but the way that he talks is so smooth, and you'll realize that what he's done at the beginning of the sentence is lit the fuse, and by the time you get to the end...
It's too late.
It's too late, your brain's going to explode. So yeah, it's really cool. All right, well, I think that's all we have. So definitely, you know, let us know if you want to know more about Total Chaos. Go to chaosgroup.com/total-chaos, or just look up Total Chaos 2019 and you'll be able to have all the information out there on the internets. And of course, remember to rate, subscribe, like, and share our podcast, CG Garage. All right. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're going to fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Thanks, dude, for doing this. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Anytime.
I guess, you know, you and I have met several times over the years. I think the first time I remember contacting you was because of the Gnomon DVDs that I did.
Yeah, yeah. That was years ago, dude.
Years ago. This is, yeah, so at least 12, 13.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it had to have been probably 2005, 4, no, 6 maybe.
Five or 6.
Yeah.
And I remember that you and I having a conversation where I was, you know, putting out the DVDs and you sent me an email saying, yeah, we need to make a second batch of those DVDs because they were selling really well.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? And he goes, yeah. So I said, oh, it's like, yeah, they're still doing really well. And it's funny because people have, you know, they still talk about that DVD as like something that was an important part of their education system.
Oh, it was epic. I mean, you were the first, I think, to really introduce V-Ray to, I mean, where most of us were still Mental Ray Render Man, you know, in the, at least in the education side of things. You
right.
know, that was kind of where we were at, especially Render Man at that point in time. And V-Ray was just kind of just becoming a word that people were, I think, kind of pitching out there, and you're like, man, what is this thing? You
right.
know? I think when your DVDs came out, it kind of exposed a lot of people of exactly where the industry was actually going at that point in time. So,
yeah, it was a cool time. And, you know, but you guys are always an interesting part of the education system for teaching people how to do things. It was that thing where I started to realize you guys aren't just a school that's teaching people you know, in the school, in the closed system, you guys are reaching out to as many people who want to listen.
It has to be that way. I think with, we have two different companies. We have the Nomad School, we have the Nomad Workshop.
Okay.
And we treat them as sister companies. We do a lot of crossover. So a lot of our instructors at the school have done DVDs, and a lot of people who have done DVDs or now tutorials, streaming tutorials,
right,
end up finding their way when they make their way to LA, either coming in and doing, you know, some open door events, teaching inside the classrooms. And so it's more of a community building exercise, I think, more than a right. school. It's part of it is educating people. That's our top priority, but really it's about community. It's about making sure that we're there to deliver the best product, which is our students, to the entertainment arts community.
Right. But I think that's what's so good about it is that, you know, people look at that Nomad School brand now as something that's going to deliver the state-of-the-art information. And it's what I mean by state-of-the-art is interesting because you guys seem to find a good balance between not just teaching technology, but also teaching the latest ideas as a concept.
Right. We look at ourselves more like an art school. Like we are an art school and you know, the more people, I mean, yes, we have to deal with technology. And I did a talk at THU or 2 years ago about the technology being your pencil, your pen, your, you know, your canvas. It really is just a tool. It's a tool set, the software right. that we use. They're all just simply tool sets, but you have to find the right balance between knowing what buttons to push, knowing why you're pushing them, and understanding what result you're going to get.
Right.
At the same time. So I think realistically an artist understands that if they pick up a specific paintbrush and they mix two paint colors together, they're going to end up with a predictable result at the end of the day.
Okay.
That's what we're trying to produce for these kids, you know, right. And then that's, that's our goal, is to basically make sure that things that they are trying to do, it's all an experiment, but it's predictable at the end of the day.
Sure. I think, but you know, as a guy, you know, how long have you been at Nomad now?
I will be there. This is the end of my 17th year. I think I'm going into my 18th.
Right.
Yeah.
So long in time. 18 years, I mean, and you always came in as a guy who was dealing with technology in some ways, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was a student there for the first year and a half or so, went out and worked in the industry. So I have the production background as well.
Right.
I kind of stumbled into Nomad. I not stumbled into it as a student. I left and I came back in. I was in between gigs and walked in one day and people were like, holy crap, we need a system administrator. Okay. Ours just left. And I was like, oh, I could do this for a month or two, you know, kind of get them through a hump and see how that all works out. And 17 years later, 18 years later, almost, it's I'm still not doing the same thing because growth obviously creates its own problems and whatnot. Right. And, but I think at the end of the day, it was a really good choice just to, you know, it just, the stars aligned during that point in time. So.
Yeah. But it's gotta be interesting because the industry that we work in, obviously, as like you said, it is a creative industry. It is an artistic, industry, but it's also an industry where, we rely on technology for us to get where we need to.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And so as such, you have to maintain technology there all the time. So that's a struggle and it's always changing.
It's always changing. And you know, it's the good news is you build partnerships with, you know, no one person in this industry, no matter how technical or how savvy they are going to know everything about everything.
Okay.
It's just impossible.
Sure.
And so you rely on partners, third parties, you rely on OEMs, you rely on different types of real partnerships and friends, mm-hmm. And that you develop over the years and years and years that can actually help guide your decision-making. So as a CTO, my entire job is really just putting the best product we can afford in front of the ownership and saying, you guys, here's my pick, but you guys still have ultimate say of where your money's going to be going.
Right.
And so what my job is just to really kind of guide them in a way to make the best decisions that they can make financially for the company and also for the students and for the staff, the instructors, faculty, and so on and so forth. So,
right.
It's staying on top of the software, you know, and I'm lucky I can still sit down. I can still you know, model a little bit. I never looked at myself as a good modeler, but right. I can model a little bit. I can texture, I can light, I can render, I can animate, and I can still test the tools against what hardware we have to make the best decision. Do we actually have to upgrade? Can we get another year or so out of this hardware before, you know, there's a noticeable tick or a talk that we need to then address?
Yeah. But you mentioned it in specifically like an idea that like, hey, we have, you know, a lot of different technology that we need to support, because you're not just dealing with one studio. You are trying to place your students in any
multiple studios, yeah.
Or industries, right? Right, it could be the gaming world. It could be the visual effects world. It could be concept artists.
Exactly.
It could be anything. So as such, you basically have to support any feasible, you know, pipeline that they're going to go into.
Exactly. And so our approach is that we bring in instructors that understand various pipelines from different studios.
Right.
And what we try to do is develop the curriculum to be as pipeline agnostic as possible.
Okay. Right?
As software agnostic as possible. Even though, yes, we have to use Maya, but we have to also use Houdini and 3ds Max. And yes, we still, you know, we render with V-Ray, but we also have people that want to render in Arnold and Redshift. And so we have to support all of these different rendering engines. But at the end of the day, and we get this question a lot from a lot of studios, they go, well, we would love for us to basically place a bunch of instructors there, and then we can teach our way of doing it.
Okay.
And we're kind of a little, you don't want to pigeonhole yourself too much into one specific pipeline, one specific,
because that's going to change anyway.
It'll change from, I mean, a studio might have one pipe or one look, one show today.
Right.
And in 2 years, they're going to have 3 or 4 different productions, all with different looks, different pipelines and everything. So, we try to keep everything as agnostic as possible. With, you know, obviously we still need to be able to teach the latest tools, the latest techniques, you know, what is the industry requiring of us?
Okay.
That's how we have to look at it.
But doesn't that also mean like you got to have a ton of software then?
Yeah.
How much software do you have? Like you were telling me, like how many?
I think it's 135 packages that we have to support, and and it has to be on every workstation. So the way that
workstation has 135,
roughly, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And so we're talking multiple versions of Maya. We're talking about different versions of Houdini. We're talking about different, different rendering software for different applications. So you'll have Redshift for Maya, you'll have Redshift for Houdini, you're going to have V-Ray for X, Y, and Z.
Right.
You're going to have all of these different applications for them. So I count them all differently because every single setup is different and they require different environment variable. I mean, the amount of variation that we have to support is ridiculous. And it doesn't always flow nicely.
Sure.
We do run into conflicts and bugs and, you know, I've got a great team that sorts that stuff out, but you know, those are things you can't predict. I mean, in a studio, like you would never just roll something out, you know, in the middle of a show and go, well, hope it works. You know, you're going to wait until the show's done. And then you're going to have guys in R&D testing the crap out of like, here's the new software. These are the new tests. This is what we're going to need to make sure it works. Then we'll roll it out in between. But, we can't do that.
Well, how do you keep your instructors up to date too?
They're the ones that typically request. So we know that some of the instructors will come in. The ones that teach like our introductory or foundational classes, introduction to Maya and, you know, anything that has the word intro in it, that's always going to be using the absolute latest version of the software.
Okay.
As we start moving up the chain and kind of deeper into the pipeline, you're going to get instructors that have spent 2-3 years working in maybe a 2-year-old version of Maya, 2-year-old version of Houdini.
Uh-huh.
And they know it works. And they're like, look, don't upgrade to the latest version because we haven't. That's not what I've built my studio or at least my techniques around.
Right.
And so then you're like, okay, now we have to make sure we have multiple versions of Maya. We have to have multiple versions of Houdini. We have to have, you know, and this is where it all kind of becomes a little bit more complex. Mm-hmm. Some software it works really easily.
Yep.
Some of it doesn't. It's like one version on one box. And so you kind of have to go, well, this is the version we're using. And so we have to settle on that. But it's every, you know, 3 months we have to go through the exact same process. Like, are we going to upgrade? Are we not? And it's just boiling down to getting together with our education team and just saying, here's all the updates that we have. What do you guys want on the boxes?
Right.
So yeah, it's an interesting job. It keeps me on my toes and keeps my team on their toes for sure. So,
Well, what about the hardware side of things? Obviously, hardware is a big part of it as well. And you know, the hardware out there is not cheap and
it's not complicated. Yeah, it can be. I mean, I've been building workstations since like the mid 90s. So
sure.
So I look at it as, you know, in the most simplistic way possible. It's a computer. It's a bunch of zeros and ones at the end of the day. Yep. That's it. Goes in and goes out.
Right.
How fast it does it. What the IO is going to look like. Right. It really depending on the software that we're going to be running. And so, you know, with today's tech, where things have become more complex is really with the advent of GPU and all of the GPU processing that we're doing.
So GPU has been a big change in your hardware.
That's been a big change because, I mean, back in the day, it was just really just to put graphics in front of somebody on a screen.
Right.
You know? So, and how fast can you tumble a complex model in Maya or Houdini or
right. whatever it just is. Just make right? sure you have a fairly current driver and you're good to go.
Right. Right. Yeah. And just make sure it's tested. Today's it's like, you know, we're trying to basically, you know, eke out every, compute second that we possibly can out of a card. And, right. you know, in some cases it's, you know, we do have some, I wouldn't say older hardware. I mean, we try to swap things out every 3 years.
Right.
So that's the turn that we're pretty much on. GPUs 2 to 3 years is probably about its max, but when you start looking at compute on a CPU or memory architecture and that kind of stuff, I mean, you can really get 4 to 5 years out of it pretty easily as long as you swap.
Yeah, because the CPU side of things has not changed enough.
It didn't until the last version of the Xeon CPUs.
Okay, so what's going on there?
So when we started looking at the Purley CPU structure, they call it the Intel, the Xeon scalable architecture, I think is what it's called. You're talking about 6-channel memory where, you know, in most cases, you know, standard PCs is dual channel, maybe quad channel if you get really lucky and you,
right.
you know, but you never see 6 channels of RAM on anything until Purley. And so you want to basically stack as much RAM into those things as you can because you've got all the pipe for it.
Right.
And so everything has to, at some point, sit on a RAM stick. It has to. I mean, it doesn't matter what you're doing. It's going to sit there. And so you combine that with NVMe on the storage end.
Yes.
With all these PCIe lanes with the GPU side of things. And you can just put together, I mean, a blazing fast machine.
Right.
The problem is that those types of processes aren't clocked very high. And so our dilemma is always, well, they're great for visual effects. They're great for rendering. They're great for the heavy lifting jobs that we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to real time, when it comes to gameplay, because again, we have two completely different types of programs, right? The gameplay requires a lot of high freak. So you want the high frequency stuff on that end. So what we've done is we blend, you know, we have some labs that are high clocks, you know, quad channel memory, that kind of stuff. And then we have the Purley CPUs that are sitting, you know, 12 core, 64 gigs of RAM, but they're taking advantage of the full 6-channel memory on those.
Right.
And the problem is that we have to basically put every class in any lab. So, so there's going to be some of our labs, which are 15 seats.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully if we have a game class, that's one of those, we put those in a high clocked, high frequency type of lab with a good graphics card in it. If not, they go on the big 12 cores and, you know, they seem to work pretty fine as well.
Okay.
So, yeah. We're not handcuffing them at any point. So.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I'm just curious, like, you know, obviously were you guys always doing games or games became something that was.
Games became something a couple of years ago. I mean, we've been always placing students in our, in game studios. We've been doing that for years. I mean, years and years and years.
Sure.
But the problem is that as the technology started to change and engines became a big thing and people started looking at, well, let's just move this over to Unreal instead of developing our own engine. Mm-hmm. We'll put it on something a little more standardized. It became more important for our students to understand that part of the pipeline, developing assets that they could quickly bring into Unreal or into Unity or something to that effect. So, and then also with the visual effects world going real time now for all the previs and some, I mean, just basic setup stuff. It's just unbelievable.
Virtual production.
Yeah. Like yeah. That. Yeah.
It's interesting that real time has become such an important part of the education right now. And do you, like you said, I think you're right. It's when engines became like applications.
Yes. Yes. And they didn't have to develop their own. I mean, you can still do a lot of development over the top of these things, but at the end of the day, a person can sit down with a computer and make their own video game.
Right. It's amazing.
Which is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, 20 years ago, if you wanted to use a real-time renderer, you had to license it.
Yes.
For the video game.
Yes.
And licensing a real-time engine, let's say, like you said, if I want to make a video game and I want to license, you know, the Quake engine an example.
It was like $1 million.
I think it was, it was $1 million.
Yeah.
Just to license that.
Just to license it. But for production. And then I think Unreal kind of broke out and said, look, if you guys want to do something indie, that's great. We'll take a percentage.
Right.
And that's when the game started to change a little bit. And you know, with the advent of, I think what it was it became more accessible to people. They could sit down. It looked like every other 3D application that they've ever used.
Right.
And you get these VFX guys that kind of sit there and they go, what if we were to put in virtual cameras? We could do all of our previs,
right?
All of our virtual production side of things, just to plot and plan things out,
right?
And show the director exactly what we are expecting this thing to actually look like,
right?
You know? So it becomes cool. It's like it's the world, and I've seen this over, you know, last almost 20 years now doing this stuff. There's a wave that brings the two industries together, and then something forces them apart and they come back together and it forces them apart.
Right.
And it's been like that for the last 17, 18 years since I've been a professional.
Right.
I don't see that ever going away. I think that there's some things in games that are only going to be segmented for games, and there's going to be things in production that are going to be segmented for only production. But at the end of the day, it's really kind of a neat thing where you can see the two kind of coming together, where the tools and the processes and the you know, everything kind of crosses over.
Right.
And that's a really neat thing to actually watch. It's cool.
It's interesting. Cool. I mean, so do you guys have a curriculum that's, you know, four games and a curriculum that's four visual effects?
Yes. Yeah. And they're almost exactly the same for about the first year of their vocational side. And then that's when they start to branch out. So where, you know,
building assets is similar in both.
It's exactly the same.
Right.
It's exactly the same. You will get to a certain point where all of a sudden it becomes high-res assets that you would use for film that you wouldn't necessarily use for a game. Although, you know, if you've already got the low base mesh, or you got the low-res mesh in for a high-res model, you just literally project all your high-res detail right onto it and you've got yourself a game model.
Right.
And so you can kind of use the same techniques for both. Where you get into slight differences is things like look development. Mm-hmm. Like you would do that for a film, not necessarily for a game. Although we're seeing more look dev going into games, it's just a slightly different process.
Right.
So
you have to still be fairly efficient for real time.
Yes. Yes. You have to be. And that's where the technology there, you get to a certain point where it's like, you can still push a lot of poly through it. You can still push a lot of texture through it. But if you want a smooth playback, like you actually want to put some VR goggles on and walk around in a world, it better be pretty much optimized. I mean, otherwise you're going to start slowing down.
You got to be like super high res and do 90 frames a second.
Right? Yes. 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 And it gets nuts, yeah. Or even like for just basic single screen video games now that are 120 frames. I mean, literally 120 frames, 144, you know, hertz refresh rates on some of these monitors. You got to make sure that the stuff is clean and that you can move fast. So
yeah,
it's about optimization. So
interesting.
Yeah.
What are some of the studios that you've noticed in the gaming industry that are looking out for places like what you guys are doing?
Oh,
what
God.
Are they demanding?
They all are. They want good, clean, efficient modelers,
right?
Texture artists, animators. They want people that can actually go in and build levels and worlds and environment artists. The environment is a big thing. I mean, a lot of people, 90% of our students come out and they show up and they go, I want to be a character artist. And you go, everybody does, right? Everybody does. But there's so many other avenues that you can take, and you don't have to sit there and sculpt humans all day or monsters all day. You know, you can build houses and stop signs and garbage cans and still have a very fruitful career.
Right.
You know, as long as you can do them efficiently.
Right.
But it's all about efficiencies. At the end of the day, it's about making sure that these kids understand coming in that it's not always just about the art. It's about hitting deadlines. It's about being able to plan and plot and work backwards from that deadline so that they can make sure that they hit them every single time. It's no different whether you're in a game world or if you're in VFX it doesn't matter what job you're in. There's a deadline for a reason. And you start missing them, people start missing paychecks at that point. So, you know, at the end of the day, that's the most important thing. So it's really just kind of making sure that regardless of whether or not we train somebody that's of, you know, somebody that's doing VFX, it's nice that they can do VFX for both film and for games. Different techniques, but there are quite a few of our students that can kind of cross over and do both. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's another thing that I think a lot of the game studios and a lot of the film studios are also looking at is like, you know, hey, you know, this person can do this real-time stuff and it looks amazing. I wonder what they can do as far as maybe the not real-time stuff, right. You know, the pre-rendered stuff. So,
yeah, I think there's going to be, it is going to be an interesting, I mean, I looked at 2018 as like something is going to change here.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your feeling about 2018? Like, what was the big thing that suddenly like?
For us, I think it was really the, maybe not just the advent of real time, but just the overall acceptance, the cross pollination of real time became 2017, 2018, moving into 2019. I think we're going to see a little bit more of that, mm-hmm. a lot more of it specifically around VR. Mm-hmm. I'm still kind of optimistic about where it's going. I'm not really sure I have a full picture of it yet
because,
you know, again, it's like games. Yeah, that's great. For now, virtual production is such a cool, that's a cool avenue for VR.
And there's a need for it.
Like, oh, absolutely.
What's interesting about the virtual production world is that it almost seems to come out of the slowdown of Motion Builder. Like Motion Builder kind of like disappeared.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And then suddenly, like, because of Motion Builder, that pretty much was the only game in town to do any kind of virtual production. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, because it started to, other people's like, there's an opportunity there. Now, virtual production is huge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nobody does anything without it for the most part.
Right.
You know, and you're wasting money if you do for the most
exactly,
part.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you have to, like, you know, when you go on set, it's like, I know exactly what it's going to look
yeah,
like.
Yeah. And, you know? And without that, again, it's about making things predictable. And that's ultimately at the end of the day, it's like, that's what it's all about. It's like making sure you know, when you put that right foot in front of the left, that you know, you're not going to fall on your face or step in a hole.
Right.
You know? And so, it's, I think the virtual production side, I'm really optimistic in terms of where the VR is going to take, you know, whether it's in visual effects, whether it's in the game side. It looks like that's going to be kind of like where things are going to be going. But I'm also seeing, you know, kind of looking at the new PCI Express, PCIe 5, and I'm, you know, as a tech guy, I'm looking at where that's going to impact networks across the studio, across the pipeline.
Okay.
And, you know, even in post-production, I mean, you know, you need massive amounts of bandwidth to go in and start editing full 4K content.
Sure.
And most places don't have that massive a bandwidth, you know, to do 4K to 8K to whatever the next K is going to be.
Right.
And so with PCIe 5, in most places just bypass PCIe 4 at this point, right? They're just kind of like, we're waiting for 5 to come out. And you're going to see 400 gigabit cards. Like it's going to be ridiculous fast.
Network
cards.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really what it's going to be for. And at that point, I mean, you're talking about fiber cards and, you know, looking more towards the Mellanox, you know, mm-hmm. InfiniBand type style of networks, but
that's expensive. It's still,
but when you need it, you need it. I mean, and I think that
we bought a 1 meter InfiniBand card, and it cost us a cable.
Yeah,
and it cost us like $100.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's not the cables are the cheap part. The cards,
and I then understand
the storage but I'm and switches.
Just the cable cost you $100. Oh, yeah. A one meter cable.
Oh yeah, yeah. But it's like very few places really need it. But if you, I mean, before we were really going to see a lot of 4K and 8K content, really for the mainstream, right?
Okay.
You're going to need studios to upgrade to that. That's the only way to do it. That's
right.
The only way to do it. And you're not going to do that on gigabit.
You know? Right.
So at the end of the day, you know, you're looking at these new technologies that are coming out, not just InfiniBand for fiber, but we're talking about full-blown PCI Express networks. Right. We're talking about liquid tech, and we're you know, it's going to change the face of how we move data around large spaces and even across the globe,
right?
At some extent. So, I'm looking at PCIe 5, and you know, some of it, you know, may end up being graphics related. I don't really see the need for it just yet.
Okay,
you know, maybe, but I don't see us pushing that much bandwidth for graphics anytime soon.
Interesting.
I see it more for network and for storage.
That's interesting you say that, because they would assume that like graphics would be a big hog of bandwidth.
We're not even taking advantage of the PCIe 3 yet.
For graphics.
For graphics, yeah. So, I mean, and even for storage to some extent, but, if, you know, for local storage, I mean, PCIe 2 would probably be fine for right. NVMe for the most part. When you start looking at it, you know, opening that up to these, you know, billion IOP, you know, server farms that with tons of NVMe on it.
Right.
That you can literally stream and edit a full 12K frame if you want to.
Right.
It's ridiculous. I mean, it gets to a point where that's where I see it making that next level, that next jump, so that they can actually create full-blown, I mean, real 4K content for the mainstream.
Right.
Real 8K content for the mainstream.
Do you think that that's going to be a thing that people are going to do?
Yeah.
You think so? You think that 4K has a shelf life?
I think that 4K hasn't really fully hit because there's too many handcuffs right now. I think that
sure.
you know, in terms of
but everyone's talking about 8K now.
Right. So
at one point we were like 4K is more than you would ever need because that's as big as an IMAX screen, and now suddenly like everyone's talking about 8K.
Well, you can shoot in it, right? That's basically
sure. you can shoot 4K, at it, but what's the point? Like
well, that's the whole thing. Is like right. that you get to a point right now where just 4K, just as a visual effects artist,
sure,
trying to do a shot for a 4K production is right. like holy shit, you know?
Right.
Like,
yeah, no, it's
ridiculous.
Yeah,
right?
It is.
I mean, I remember when HD was a thing, and oh, you know, God. Doing stuff in for 2K for film, and you're just like, holy crap, this is going to take forever to render. Now we're talking about 4K just for, you know, basic broadcast production.
Yep.
You know, and 8K for film, just to get the granularity and the detail that you need. And what I'm finding is like more and more people are like, yeah, you know, we're going to shoot it for, you know, 4.6K or 5K or whatever.
Right.
And then what we're going to do, because there's so much detail in it that is really just becomes noise. We got to drop it down to 2K and then re-up it up back to 4K to kind of smooth everything out. Yeah. And that's how you get those beautiful, I mean, you get beautiful images that way. But again, that's one extra step in the process.
Yeah.
And in order to process all that, you need massive bandwidth on the storage end.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And a lot of storage.
A lot of storage. Exactly. So NVMe, while it's super fast, it's not going to ever, you know, or get rid of platter-based drives. You're always going to need that.
Right.
But you're going to need something on the front end that's going to be able to push data quickly to an artist or to a machine that's just going to sit there and crunch, you know, transforming the, you know, from a 4K to 2K back to a 4K or up to an 8K, you know.
Right.
So, no, but I do think that that's kind of where all of that is heading. That's the only spot I see right now as just being kind of a really exciting point. We're at a good point right
so,
now.
So you right now you're like, when you're looking to future, it's about bandwidth.
Oh, it's all bandwidth. Yeah. Yeah. IOPS and bandwidth. And, you know, it's about processing when, especially, you know, if we're going to be doing stuff in real time,
right.
You need the super high IOPS. Like it's not just bandwidth at that point. You need to make sure that you can actually process, you know, however many cores there are on a single GPU or multi GPUs. You need to make sure that those IOPS match.
Right.
Otherwise you bottleneck. And so, you know, those are the things that, as I'm kind of like looking at speccing workstations and whatnot, my biggest thing is IOPS. It's IOPS and bandwidth.
Okay.
How much are we going to need? And you know, luckily right now, like I think it's a 40 gigabit backbone. It's nothing huge.
Okay.
But we don't run InfiniBand. We run it over iSCSI.
Okay.
And the only reason we did that is again, it's cutting cost a little bit so that we can, yes, there's a little bit of overhead. Yeah. But we don't have to run separate switches, separate storage, separate everything, separate cards in the machines just for storage use.
Right.
We can use our TCP IP network for that. So,
right.
So, and again, we pass those cost savings down to the student so they don't have to break the bank by coming to Noman.
Right.
At the end of the day.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? So you guys have to be, I mean, you still have to, you know, maintain a certain cost level because your enrollment is not that big. You
mentioned
like your full-time students are only 250 and then you have another 200 or
it's
so
about
part-time.
It's about 2 to 250 and another 2 to 250 part-time. Yeah.
Right. So that's a small school.
Yeah. Very small.
And there's a reason you guys made that choice to make that small school.
Yeah.
Besides the fact that you guys are, you know, have the space you have in Hollywood. What's the big reason behind that choice?
Well, there's only so many jobs. Good. I think we said this earlier. There's only so many good jobs in the industry for these guys.
Right.
And our job at the end of the day, our mission is to basically place these guys, right? We are vocationally geared, meaning we train people, whether it's in our Bachelor of Fine Arts degree, our 2-year vocational program, mm-hmm. they're all vocationally targeted. So
okay.
our job is basically to bring these people in, train them, and get them a job.
Right.
Get them a good job.
Right.
And so the thing is that if you bring in 10,000 students, there aren't 10,000 jobs in the industry for these people.
Nope.
You know? And so you can't push them out faster than the jobs.
Other people would like you to believe that, but no one is realistic about
right.
it.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk to accountants and stuff right. or, you know, financial planners, that's what they want out of it. Right.
right.
They want that type of growth. And at the end of the day, you have to do it responsibly.
Right.
If you do it irresponsibly, you're going to end up with placement rates in the 60, 50, 40 percentile. And that's not where you want to be.
Right.
You guys want to be at the top. It's in the 90s. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that means at least 90% of your students, if not more, have jobs when they
graduate. Yeah, most of them, I'd say almost 100% for the most part. Uh-huh. Every once in a while, there's one or two, or you know, they either have visa issues. I mean, we still have to report those as like, hey, they couldn't get a job.
Right.
It doesn't mean that they're not good enough to work here. It's just that their visa ran out and they right. had to go home. And coming back in these days is a little difficult, as you might
sure.
think, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but no, it doesn't mean that they won't find jobs in their country.
Right.
Either. So, and we have quite a few that do, and then our placement rate, we go in and adjust those numbers and whatnot.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But okay. So now if you limit your students to 250 full-time students, as an example, right. I'm just going to go with a full-time yeah. rounds for now. That means that you guys can pick
we do.
The best 250 students.
That's trick.
Kind of be a really interesting admissions process. Right?
It's a trick. Yeah. And the thing is, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get the number of qualified applicants up so we can take our pick of the cream of the crop.
Right.
That's really what our goal is.
So and, what is your acceptance rate? I mean, it's gotta be,
it's higher than what we would like it to be.
Let's interesting. Just
put it that way. Yeah. I think that, you know, it's not that we accept everybody that comes in, cause we don't, but we
right.
don't have a quota, meaning that if we've got 100 applicants that come in and we see 30 of them that are actually qualified to actually get in, we'll accept 30.
Okay.
If we get 100 applicants and only 20 of them look like they're actually qualified to get in, we accept 20.
So you are also picking the students knowing that they have a better chance
yes,
of getting a job.
We have right? to. We have to.
That's so
yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
We yeah. I mean, it's a little mean-spirited because
well,
there's a lot of, you know, in the vocational realm, and
right.
you guys, you say you're a vocational school, but the vocational realm right now is a lot of like, hey, you know, learn to be a tractor driver, whatever it
mm-hmm,
is,
mm-hmm.
and they'll accept anyone.
Right.
And someone may not, they're like, I don't know what I want to do. Maybe I'll do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a lot of people's like, you know what? I want to work for Pixar.
Oh, yeah. Yep. We get that all the time. I was given a tour, and this was many years ago, and
right.
it was a father and son that had come in, and I'm walking them around, and it was their first time on our campus, and
uh-huh.
And I was like, you know, why do you want to be an effects artist? Why do you want to be an artist in this industry?
Right.
You know? And I think the dad was the one that chimed in. He goes, well, he likes watching fucking movies. And I was just like, I don't know if this is the
That's
right
not
place
the qualifying
for you.
Yet,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, he likes watching movies. And I was like, well, everybody likes watching movies, but do you like making things?
Right.
Like that's what it's more about. It's like, are you a builder?
Right.
Are you a maker of things? And,
right.
And you know, so it's not for everybody. I mean, it's a hard career. I mean, most people don't understand how difficult it is to make both technical and artistic decisions on
right.
things under a tight deadline. It's a very difficult task. And people who have done it, you know, you look back and you go, man, I can't believe I got that shot done. Or I can't believe that we were able to pull that off. Man,
right.
we had to cut all these corners and it still looked good. There's all of that. And you got to be able to train them for those. Like, hey, there's going to be some times where you're going to have to cut a corner and it's not going to be your best work. And as long as it sells on screen, it's good.
Right.
That's it. It's never about accuracy necessarily, right? We're magicians.
Right.
And, but at the end of the day, it's about delivering things on deadline. It's about making the best you can do in that short amount of time. And, you know, have a short memory. Move on to the next gig as soon as, I mean, it's not always going to be your best work.
Right.
It almost never will be.
Right.
Because it, you know, it's never done. It's just due. And you know, that's kind of what we have
yeah,
to train these guys.
But you
for.
Also have to do something.
Yes. You have to do something.
Right. And then you have to produce something and it has to be done. And you're right. Artists are never really good at editing themselves
right,
and saying,
right.
this was great. I'm done.
You yes. know, like, yes. Yes.
Those who do, you kind of questions like,
are you really done?
Right,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Or yeah. why aren't you done yet?
Right. But there's always yeah. going to be a little bit yeah. of that in to some extent. What was I did a podcast with Max Berman, and he was quoting his grandfather, I guess, or someone, or maybe it was his dad. And he goes, excuses don't make it on the screen.
Yeah.
You know, like you got to have something done.
Yeah. You have to. Yeah. You can't just sit there and twiddle your thumbs. It's like you know,
well,
you
get it done tomorrow. It's like, well, the deadline was yesterday.
Yeah. That's not a good place to be.
And so that's something you have to teach in the school, right? Obviously you have deadlines.
Well, that's why, you produce homework assignments, they have final projects, they pick and choose kind of what they want to do for their work. But at the end of the day, as an instructor, you know, I used to teach 3-4 different classes. I taught for 12 years. And
what were you teaching?
Mostly it was shader development, texture painting, some lighting. I taught a bunch of different things.
Okay.
But most of it was around the realm of rendering, look, texturing, shading, look development,
okay,
for the most part. And so, you know, you kind of see what they want to actually do. And then your job is you basically have to supervise them and go, let's go ahead and scale this on back a little bit. Or why don't we go ahead and fake this? Because you don't want to have to build that. You know, let's just go ahead and matte paint it or do whatever you need to do with it. Because, you know, as a student, they don't know what they don't know yet.
Right.
And so a lot of times, you know, they see something on screen and they go, I want to do the next Avengers. And you go, no, let's go ahead. And, you know, you're in like your first 6 months at the school. Like, let's go ahead and scale it back. And
How do you teach those limitations? Because that's going to be tough. I remember when I was teaching, you know, I was doing back in the, you know, 97, 98, I was teaching at Rice and I was teaching the CG stuff to the architecture students, and they're like, they wanted to literally make a Pixar movie in this class.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah,
dude, you have one computer.
Yeah.
Think about what's possible.
Right.
And how do you teach that, like, get the most out of the time and resources you have?
You got to let them fail sometimes.
You got to let them fail.
You have to. I mean, where's the best place to do that? It's in school. It's in school. You're going to fail. And that's what that, you know, if you don't learn from that,
right,
then you got a problem. But most people with common sense learn from their failures.
How do they deal with that? How do students learn with failing? Like, it's got to be tough.
It's tough. But the thing is that you try to give them enough of a buffer so that they're not going to fail a class. They'll fail maybe on an assignment. They realize how hard it is. And so, you know, I used to go and give lectures, you know, and I'm sitting here looking at this, the sticker you just gave me. It says everything has Fresnel on it. Right. And it was one of my lectures. I used to teach it in both, like, my hard surface texturing and shading class was just kind of a look dev class. And I was like, I would go in, I'd be like, we're going to go ahead and build these Fresnel shaders from scratch. You know, so we're going to go ahead and put in all the controls for them so you can adjust things and da 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 da. And I just want you to just render these on a ball, put them on a sphere just to see what it looks like. And they would come back and go like, that was freaking hard. And I was like, I know, this is why I give it to you. And now we're going to do it the easy way. And we'll just use an Uber shader or something,
right.
And they would just get pissed off because they were like, you know, why didn't you show us that week one?
Well, now you know how to do it.
Now you know how to do it from scratch. You know what you're doing. There's a why behind the input control that
you
basically mapped. So, but you know, you do things like that. It's just really just kind of giving them enough of a buffer, giving them an assignment that is definitely achievable, but with some challenge, making sure that there's a challenge in there that they don't even know of. Cause you know, all of us can get up there and we can make something look awesome in half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, maybe. We can make something look really, really cool. Sometimes you fall on your face if you're turning something new, but as you get into this autopilot mode, you get up there and you start wrapping stuff up and you kind of start throwing texture together. You know, it's going to work perfectly, but you also know where the gotchas are going to be when they start doing their own stuff. And I'm not going to always highlight it, but I'm always like, hey, you might want to watch out for this. Hey, you might want to watch out for that. Mm-hmm. And the ones that are sitting there kind of, you know, taking notes, sometimes we'll actually run into it and go, oh yeah, yeah, Miller said this one time. And then there's ones that just run into problems and then they fail and, you know, they come into class and you crit them, you know? So we do a lot of, in our first hour of every class for the most part is all crit.
Right.
So it's just like sitting in a production studio and sitting in there with
doing walkthroughs, right?
And doing walkthroughs or, you know, doing dailies and, you know, you're kind of sitting there going like, this is a problem.
Right.
You know, and then you gotta, you know, sometimes.
And how big are your classes?
They're not huge. I think the maximum, their biggest classroom is, I think, 18.
Okay, 18 that's seats. Teeny. Yeah.
Yeah. And we try to keep everything around anywhere between 12 and 18.
Interesting.
And so you can get that one-on-one time. You can spend 5 to 10 minutes per student doing crit, opening up scene files, taking a look, showing them how to fix things and so on. So it's very personal.
Right.
For a lot of the instructors, for the faculty, for even the tech team, I mean, we know almost all the students.
Right.
So,
250, yeah. You probably know everyone by name.
Yeah. Or at least you know their face and you know kind of what classes they're in, you know what terms they're in.
Right.
And, but yeah, it's you know, it's a give and take, you know, sometimes you gotta be hard on people that you really like. And I used to always tell kids, it's like, look, I'm going to like every single one of you guys, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean I'm not going to put my foot in your ass when I need to.
Right.
And don't take it. I'm not trying to personalize it. It's not about me saying, picking you out.
Right.
If I see you dragging your feet and I know you've got a lot more potential than that, I'm going to crack the whip a little bit more on you.
Right.
If I know that you struggle with X, Y, or Z, I'm going to try to help you out. And we're hopefully going to get everybody up to the same caliber by the time you guys walk out of here.
Right.
And that's what it's about. And, yeah, it's a lot of work and there's curriculum redos. I mean, that's where the instructors are just magic. I mean, they go through and they rewrite their curriculum every quarter. They have to rewrite things to kind of pop in new techniques, get rid of some old stuff that's no longer.
It's not like an old math class where nothing's changed.
Nope. Yeah, exactly. Or a painting class where nothing's changed. Right. You know? So.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. All right. So here's, I think, what would be a good thing to as we're believe it or not, we've actually gone quite
over
a while.
But holy crap.
What I'd like actually to sort of think about is, let's think about someone out there who may be listening, who's thinking about getting a career in this and thinking about, you know, maybe going to Noman or what they're trying to do. What are some of the things they should prepare for? Let's say it's like, I'm some kid that lives in Australia, let's say, right? And I'm thinking about like, all right, I want to go into Noman, sounds like a great opportunity for me. What should I do to prepare to go to Noman? What do I need to get out there to really be part of that curriculum?
I would say draw every day.
Draw every day
by hand on paper with a pencil. Draw every day. And it's not because we need you to be the greatest draftsman.
Right.
That's not really what it's about. You'll become a good draftsman.
Right.
It's not about that. It's about your observation skills.
Okay.
As a visual artist.
Yep.
Right. You can't just invent shit in your head.
Right.
Right. It's not ever going to come out of your head. It's about, you're going to be taking it from a concept artist. You're going to be taking it and matching something from real life that you got to like do a digital double of. Right.
Okay.
So your observation skills, the way that you read form, silhouette, highlights, what the materials, it's soft, hard, is it, you know, you got to be able to identify that with your eyeballs and have your brain process it.
Right.
But drawing it's not really about how great you can draw. It's about your observation skills. At the end of the day, that's what it's about. Photograph, go out and get a camera and photograph stuff.
Yes.
That also helps, you know, that also helps a lot, but, but really you're, you know, as an artist, you're also dealing, you know, the drawing part is it's hand eye. And it's just another hand-eye thing. It's not, it just gets you into that flow.
Okay.
And so a lot of our students, you know, they come in, a lot of them have to have a traditional portfolio along with some digital stuff on it. So
what kind of digital stuff do they need to know? I mean, or do they need to know much?
Not much. I mean, they come in, we've had some artists, like when I came in and I started at Noman in 2000, I come from a fine art background.
Right.
So I painted, that was my thing. I painted. I did a little bit of digital stuff, but I all my real digital stuff was dealing with databases and stuff when I was with the bank. So,
I had
that technical aspect, but I was a fine artist and I was like, I'm getting away from all this financial crap. I'm going to go be an artist. You know, that's what I thought. And then you get into it and you start falling in love also with the technology and how it blends. The key thing is that you want to be able to build things. Show us that. Yeah. You can model a little bit, right? You don't have to model great. But show us you're not afraid of 3D tech.
Right.
You know, so we get a lot of artists that come in that are phenomenal illustrators. Phenomenal.
Okay.
They get in Photoshop and they play around with it. Oh, this is so great. This is so great. The first 3D class they take, they bomb. And it's hard. It's a whole different way your brain has to think.
Yep.
So I would say make sure that you're playing around in 3D software. It doesn't matter if it's Modo, if it's Maya, if it's Max, if whatever
ZBrush,
it is,
whatever,
ZBrush. Make sure you're playing in those applications and make sure that it isn't going to be a learning curve that you can't really overcome.
Okay.
Right. That's a big thing. But yeah, we do want to see that there's digital and analog, as we like to call it, traditional skills. Part of it, just so we know that you've got the hand eye and that you've got the observation skills to pull it off.
Right.
And then secondly, you're not afraid of the tech.
Right.
So there has to be that kind of common bond between the two. So,
right.
And that's really it. And then it's just work. It's just work your butt off.
Right.
You know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, if you ain't got anything better to do, draw, build something.
Okay.
You know, if you find yourself in your free time, not doing that and doing something else, that something else is your hobby. It's okay. Not the art at the end of the day. So we want those people, but we also, like I said, you know, people come in with very little tech skill, very little art skill, and they somehow get in.
Right.
And their work ethic is just amazing, and they end up destroying everybody. They're sometimes the kings when they leave. Yeah, so it's weird. You never know.
I think it's interesting. Now there's obviously, you know, in today's world, internet, et cetera, there's enormous amount of resources to learn techniques
absolutely.
On the internet. Right. Yeah,
absolutely.
But you guys what are you guys offering that's different than that or above that?
Well, so we have the online school. So I'm not the CTO. I'm also what's called the director of distance education. So I run our online school. Currently we can't offer our classes to students who live within the United States that are outside of the state of California. It's just the way that the accreditations are set up. And so it's
so,
not anything.
So wait, was you can't offer what?
Explain we can't that. Offer our online classes. Now this doesn't deal with the Noman workshop.
Right.
Noman school proper
right.
Has an online course set.
Okay.
And we used to be able to offer it to anybody around the world. We switched accreditors, some laws changed, and they said, you know what, unless you have state approval from all 50 states, you can't offer your classes in those states.
Wow.
And so we're like, okay, well, we'll go ahead and pull it because it would cost
way too
much.
So you can only offer
in the state of California.
Only offer kids who live in California an online class.
State of California and anybody who lives outside of the boundaries of the United States.
Right.
Yeah. So we do offer that to people, but the Noman workshop kind of fills the gap a little bit. The only thing that's really
different. The Noman workshop is not a degree.
It's not a degree. And neither are the online classes. Our online classes, they transfer in. The credit transfers do work. Everything's right. Cool there. But it will not lead to a degree. We don't offer the full set.
Online, yeah. You can't just stay at home and get a degree.
You have to come to Noman to get a degree right. Or to get a certificate. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So we want people to be here.
But there is a workshop. You do your workshop.
Oh,
right?
The workshop.
And you guys
is
are one of the pioneers of honestly speaking, of teaching visual effects like through DVDs or.
I think we were the first. Yeah.
You were.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a big thing. Like, yeah. You know, I remember, you know, when Eric Hansen was, uh-huh. was there and was working with workshop, and he was the one who got me into doing the DVDs. It's like, the vast resources of stuff.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, we started off with it was just Alex and Darren, the co-owner of Noman, that were putting tutorials together and they called it recording. They weren't even DVDs then. We were streaming online. No, they had VHS tapes.
Yes.
And then we also had an online version of it. So one of my first things that I did at Noman was I had to build a compression kind of pipeline. So they would record all the stuff and it was kind of a mix of analog and digital and whatever. And they would mix it. And then I would have to transcode everything down into a set that could actually play back smoothly on like back in DSL days, you know, at the best. So,
right.
So that was my, one of my first like real, like kind of tools that I had to actually kind of develop. So, but yeah, we were one of the first to do that. I mean, Linda was another one at that time. And I don't know of any others to be honest with you. So it was Noman and Linda. But on the visual effects side, we were it. Like that was really about it. So, and then I think the next batch was, I think Alex bringing in Ryan Church and Feng Zhu.
Yeah,
And those guys to do some concept art.
Sid.
Yeah. And then it was just kind of like from there, it just kind of took off. It became its own company and you know, they moved into the building and I set them up and then it was like Eric Hansen, Meets Meyer, this guy, Sean Mills.
Yep.
And there was a whole group of producers and they were also making their own content.
Their own content as well. Yeah. And it was funny because, and I remember speaking to Alex about, you know, the Noman stuff. And I said, you know, and he says, I don't know. He's like, yeah, Eric says you should do something on V-Ray and Maya and Max. And he's like, he was not a Max guy.
Oh, no. He's a Maya snob.
And some Maya snob. And I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then he was like, I don't know if it'll sell real well. It turned out it sold really well.
Everything back in those days was selling really well.
Yeah. I think what was interesting, I don't know if you know this, but one of the reasons that DVD or those two DVDs that I did sold really well is that Jeff Muddle at CG Architect, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So he was a reseller of V-Ray. And because he was a reseller of V-Ray, he would basically get V-Ray at a discount and then would sell. So he would sell V-Ray at a full price, but in order to make him you know, more appealing as a reseller, right. he offered the free two DVDs, which
go.
Weren't free yeah. to him. He bought them outright.
Yeah.
But I was everyone who bought a copy of V-Ray was getting my DVDs from Jeff.
And I was like, that's awesome.
This is awesome. Yeah. I was like, well, it was a great idea. And that was a great resource for people. You
sure.
know? Because absolutely. He was like, this is the only thing I know how to teach people how to do this stuff.
Oh, yeah. You were the only person for years that really went deep into V-Ray.
Okay.
For years.
Thank you. But yeah. that's not just me. I mean, like, there was stuff that I was like, there is amazing resources out there. You want to learn how to do concept art like Feng was doing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Think about it. You can watch 6 hours of, you know, Sid Mead drawing.
Yep. Yeah. You're never going to see that
anymore. You're never going to see that again.
Or learn, go out and learn perspective from, like on there. It's literally, it goes, right. it traverses the full spectrum.
Yeah.
It's foundational art. When I was running the workshop, I like to focus on a lot of the foundational stuff.
Right.
It was like figure drawing, perspective, you know, some color theory. I mean, you've got, you know, everything from you know, doing, you know, high level 3D matte painting in Mari
right.
to doing figurative gesture drawing with right. Jack Bosson. And so, you know, we tried to cover all of the bases, as many as we can, because, you know, there's people out there again with limited resource, right? They might right. have the $40 or $50 a month it costs to subscribe, but they don't have a high end computer.
Yeah.
Right. What do they have? What does pretty much everybody have? You can find a piece of charcoal or something and a piece of paper to draw on.
Right.
And so it's kind of one of those lowest common denominators, but to get that kind of inspiration from people that have worked in the industry,
right.
the people that could actually go out and say, well, you know, hey, you might not have to have Photoshop to paint with, but we're going to show you how to paint for real.
Right.
Like kind of thing, you know? Yeah. And so it's important to kind of cover all the bases and kind of meet the artists where they are. Because
okay.
it doesn't mean that just because you paint on canvas still that you can't be an artist in this industry.
Right.
It doesn't mean anything. It just means that you're going to have to change your tool set. Again, they're just tools.
Yep.
So a computer and the processor and all that stuff is your paintbrush and your oil paints and yep. all the other stuff.
And it's going to change every
and
year.
It'll change. Yeah. Those yep. tool sets will change. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just so we can round it up a little bit. So what kind of degrees do you guys offer? You said you have some part-time stuff. Obviously, you have your online school as well and your Nomen workshop, which are different.
Sure. Yeah.
But what kind of degrees do you guys offer out there?
So right now there's a two-year vocational certificate.
Okay.
And about their first year, at the end of their first year, they kind of pick a pathway, right?
Okay.
So are you at a point right now where you want to study – you know, kind of character sculpting and modeling? Do you want to go into more, you know, shading, lighting, comp? Do you want to get into actual visual effects? Do you want to go into games? So they're allowed to branch out and then kind of go into a little bit more of a, you know, kind of condense their learning into something that they're more interested. So when they leave, they could say, I got the 2-year degree, but with a focus on game design.
Okay.
Okay. And then we have a BFA that kind of does the exact same thing.
Okay.
So we have a general Bachelor of Fine Arts degree mm-hmm. in digital production is what it's called. And the digital production realm allows you to take an artist. I don't remember which term it is, but they branch them out and they say, do you want to have a focus on visual effects, film, commercial work, whatever, or do you want to go more towards games?
Okay.
And so we branch them out. It's the same degree, but a general focus on one kind of, you know, branch versus the other.
Okay.
So we have the BFA, we have the 2-year, we have our one-off classes. So anybody can come in and say, I want to take Houdini with, you know, this instructor over
right.
here and sign up for the class, show up to class and, you know, learn Houdini.
Right.
Anybody can do that.
And you have nighttime classes for
yeah.
people.
Yeah. 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 They're all, most of our classes are 7 to 10, but, there are some that are, you know, 1 to 4, 4 to 7, those kind of time slots as well, but they're okay. all 3 hours or 10 weeks. And they're on the weekends as well. So if you've got time on the weekends, that's when a lot of our classes actually run, is on the weekends.
Interesting.
Yeah. So we're pretty much a 24/7 shop.
Yeah. It sounds like it because yeah. obviously you can't, you're not like, you know, you don't go to class at 8 a.m., right?
9 a.m. It opened. The doors, right. yeah, our doors open up at 8:30 and we shut our doors at 1:30 in the morning. So
wow.
those are our days. Yeah.
Wow.
So.
But yeah, because a lot of your instructors work too, right?
And they all work. All of them work. It's not just some, it's like they all work. There's some of the, that are, you know, we find some of them that are like in between gigs, which is like awesome because then they come in and teach multiple classes for us.
Right.
But
and they get paid between gigs.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, which they love. Yeah. So it's kind of a nice, it's a nice, give and take.
Yeah,
for sure.
All right. Well, that's awesome, Eric. I mean, I think this is really good to get people to understand what it's like to work in the industry, where to go and the resources they have to them.
Right.
And I think Noman is, you know, Noman's been around 20 plus years now.
I think this will be our 21st year. Yeah.
Right.
2019.
So you were there near the beginning of it.
Almost. Yeah. I think I was doing a count. I think we had 60 students total.
Right.
We had three labs, 12 seats a lab. So there were 36 seats.
Right.
And I think we had like 60, 64 students complete. At right. the entire school.
But I also think it's really interesting that you guys, you know, chose to say, okay, we want to stay, we want to make sure that our placement rate is so high that we can't grow.
Because yeah,
we know the industry is.
It's the most important. It's the most important thing. And the industry is going to, it's going to ebb and flow. So sometimes, you know, the industry needs more artists than we can produce.
Right.
That's fine. That's a good problem to have.
Right.
It's when they can't produce the jobs for us to place. And that's kind of where we have to, you know, that's our big fear, you know, as the industry kind of moves from location to location, Vancouver and London and LA and then back to, it's just moving all over the world. We want to make sure that our students, and that's why we opened up the BFA program.
Right.
And so that a student could actually leave with a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree and actually get a visa to go work outside the country. That was our prime. We spent 6 years working on the BFA program.
Interesting.
To get it accredited and everything. So it was a lot of work, and it was specifically so we had an avenue to place students either coming in from out of the country that we could place here, or our students we could place in Vancouver or London or wherever else in the world we need to place them.
Important.
So,
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Eric.
Thanks for having me, dude. No, I appreciate it.
It was fun.
Thanks, bud.